Ready to take your verdicts and jury selection to the next level? Jury consultant Harry Plotkin and trial lawyer Dan Kramer are your ticket to tipping the scales before trial begins. You're not just picking a jury, you're picking justice. Produced and powered by Law Pods.
Welcome back to another episode of Picking Justice. And Harry, today's episode is brought to us by the Bull City, Durham, North Carolina, and I will tell you why. Because it's the first time all three of us have a connection to the same city. I'll tell you mine first. So my mom is born in Durham, North Carolina. Her dad, my grandfather, fought in World War II. He grew up poor in the sand hills of southeastern or the middle of North Carolina, Hamlet and Rockingham area, then went to war, paratrooper in World War II, came back on the GI Bill, went to law school, and then hung a shingle in Durham, North Carolina. So I grew up going there multiple times a year. I love that city. And Harry, you chose to go there for college at the great University of Duke.
I did, yeah. It's a terrific city and obviously the epicenter of creating trial consultants with David, who is the Mount Rushmore, whatever you want to, trailblazer who started there. And I know I remember years ago learning that David was a professor there. And I always wondered if we overlapped when I was there. I guess just missed each other by a little bit because I was there.
When did you start there?
I started in the fall of 96.
We had about a 6-year gap. I left it around 90 or so. Okay. But also my partner Artemis is out of Duke Law School. So yes, It is the epicenter.
She may have been there when I was there.
She well may have been. I don't remember. You'd be about the, it would about seem to be right. Yeah.
Yeah. So we're really, really lucky and honored to have the great David Ball here. I got to tell you, David, when I switched over to become a plaintiff lawyer, it's like 5 years out of law school, I didn't work for a firm. I was working for a defense firm before and then just opened up my own shingle with two partners on the plaintiff side, never done plaintiff work. So I didn't have a mentor, but what I had was your incredible book, Ball on Damages 3. And I just read that constantly. I had your voice on the audio book every time I'm driving around LA going to trials. And it really... I still use your opening statement structure to this day. So the great David Balls here has done so much for the plaintiff bar and really revolutionized the way we try.
I'll quit if you keep using words like great. I still do possess some scraps of self-consciousness.
Okay, good. All right, well, let's jump into it. Let's talk jury selection. Harry, why don't you get us started?
Sure. I mean, one thing that we always love to talk about is, we talked about this a little, David, pet peeves that you have, things that we see that lawyers are doing wrong, even to this day when, lawyers are getting to the trial bar and the plaintiff side is getting so much better and better all the time, or ways that conventional wisdom is sort of leading lawyers astray when it comes to voir dire. David, when I talk about pet peeves and jury selection, anything pop into your mind? I have a million. My list is probably 1,000 things long, and I'm sure yours is too. What pops to the top of your list?
Well, let's start at the beginning. How many times, and I know you've seen this, lawyer gets up from his counsel table, if he's allowed to in North Carolina, you're not, but if you can, and walks over to where he's going to do voir dire as if he's getting up to get root canal work. A very wise and one of the very first trial consultants out there, Diane Wiley, who in many ways was one of the, she and Susie McPherson and a few other of the elders, they're still younger than me, from the National Jury Project and some others. Wiley always said the first requirement of voir dire is that you find a way to enjoy it and stop getting up as if you wish you were dead. Stop getting up as, with a clipboard in your head. You have this remarkable opportunity to find out about some human beings. And if we've learned nothing recently, people like Nick Rowley and others teaching us it's about humans, in case we didn't know that before. Well, if you don't enjoy finding out about these people, it's not like you're looking for people in the bushes who are aiming a rifle at you or going to shoot you. Maybe on the base it sort of is, but these are human beings. You got a unique chance to find out about them or any other mental trick or construct or little internal song that you love that you play to yourself when you get up. So I'm not saying get up and do giggles, but this is a privilege that you should enjoy having and make that real for yourself somehow. If you can't figure it out, send me an email, I'll help you. And that will change the juror's entire view. It'll make you much easier to talk to. They'll be much less likely to clam up on you. These people, when you first call them, they're as uncomfortable as they've ever been in public because they're being singled out. Stage fright takes over, nervousness, and they feel, you know, everything around them is power-based. They're the cog, which means even corporate executives sitting on the jury will start putting in this bluster cry, and you never get them really just talking to you.
What's the best way to do that?
Well, I think it varies by individual. Actors have to do this all the time, and that was my first career, was teaching professional actors. And you have to find ways that you can enjoy something you're doing that gives you some hunger, some thirst, some eagerness. One thing, for example, should be obvious, but it's not. It's obvious to theater folk. If you're going to do it voir dire, the night before voir dire, do a damn practice session.
100%.
Get comfortable with it, for God's sake. You're nervous. You've got a million things on your mind. You've lost 14 motions you wanted to win. And now you got to question these people to find out who's going to kill you. That's not a good human being you're putting up in front of jurors to quickly gain their credibility and likability. And even those things aside, just an open channel. Somebody like that comes. You remember when you were in school and you had a teacher who was either having a bad day or always seems to be having bad days. They're just harder people to deal with. You know, you start off with a screw you attitude toward that teacher to start with, as opposed to somebody who, you don't have to do artificial things like smile at them all as they come in. But what Artemis, my partner Artemis, suggests is as they're walking in the door and back, that's when you should start thinking of these people as real human beings. I wonder what that one's like. I wonder what they're like. Huh. Not just, are they going to be good for me or bad for me? Or am I looking like I want them to see me look like? Use that as an active moment. I don't like the bar, sitting around a bar metaphor, where it's like meeting people in a bar, because A, I hate meeting people in bars, and B, I don't think people meet people in bars anymore.
Definitely not anymore.
There's not many of them. But it's, you're in a human being business where empathy and caring about other people is either something you need to have or something you need to develop.
Yeah, I think
everybody has this naturally, but it can be developed, and that's a topic for a different day.
Yeah. I mean, I do want to highlight for the attorneys out there on this warm-up idea, like David says, theater back, a dress rehearsal, for example. I cannot stress enough how important it is the night before. Like you said, I don't care what time it is, or you come back from court, like you said, arguing motions, have your staff or your team or friends, four or five, as many as you can, get there, sit in your conference room and just practice.
Well, I like it more like a dress rehearsal in theater. I like you to bring in or have your friends and know five or six people that you don't know, complete strangers.
If you can do that.
It's not hard to do. Just have your office staff each find a person or two or put a little note on what you can do, and do it the night before. I like people doing it periodically, two or three times over the previous 2 weeks. But
oh yeah,
the night before, and the reason for that is when you then get up to do it in trial the next day, you'll feel like it's the second day of your jury selection. You'll be much more relaxed. You'll have had a chance to practice the questions. And then when you're done doing all that, when you're finished with that part, then take another whatever and do your opening in front of them. I mean, lawyers are the only people I know who take the stage without having prepared to take the stage, by which I mean you're not ready to perform when you get up there to perform.
Yeah.
And I don't want you performing in the fake sense, but the worst time for the best professional actors in the world is their first time in front of an audience. That's why no sane theater producer allows the critics to come in until after there's two or three or four previews. That's mainly so the actors pass the stage of, I don't want to put one foot down. I don't want to pick up one foot and like put the other down and I know it's securely there. You want to get that sense of freedom. And that rehearsal the night before, that practice the night before, an extensive one. Run through all the questions you're going to ask. You'll also find out which questions are just plain stupid to ask.
Yeah, we do now. I mean, we're doing probably within 2 weeks of every trial, probably 5 focus groups on that trial coming up. I was supposed to start trial, just got kicked for next week. And I just finished focus group yesterday. Same thing, voir dire opening, just to get it out there the night before, have them come to your office from 6 to 9 or whatever, however like you can do so you get a good night's rest before, and do exactly what David's talking about. If you don't have the resources, you book it on yourself. You could do it on Craigslist, pay them $20 an hour, whatever in your area, you know, you can
food
afford to.
Too. Tell them they'll be refreshed.
Yeah, food, absolutely.
To come. Let me make one warning. It is not a great idea to do focus groups to both see how the jurors are going to respond to you and how they're going to respond to the case. When Artemis and I do, well, Artemis does all the focus groups now, and you can find anyone to do this who's capable of getting up and reading these statements. You don't want the jurors responding to how they like the attorney in a focus group unless you also have the defense attorney there. Otherwise, you're going to get a totally false read. So we remove that huge variable altogether. And that's why we make people write up the case, which, by the way, is the best trial preparation I know. Is you write up the case and then you have somebody like Artemis or Harry or me, if I decide I want to do another one, I've done 8 billion of them, help you. How do we do these statements of the case? It's a great way to prepare for trial. But then we know the jurors are reacting to the content of trial and not whether they like the plaintiff's attorney, who's the real plaintiff's attorney, versus some person who isn't the defense attorney that you just dragged in to do the defense. Because that can really throw a lot of results. And I'm always surprised that so many otherwise good consultants don't seem to pay attention to that. So I like one person to do the whole presentation to take personalities out of it. And I would rather it not be the person who is presenting the case for another reason. There is nothing like sitting in the back of the room or watching from a video camera, a group of people listening to a case you wrote. Because you will learn so much just about knowing real people are now listening to it. You'll hear it with a whole new set of ears, and you will find things that are problems and that should be different that never even occurred to you. I mean, I directed 8 billion plays when I was in theater. And yet a week before opening, I would bring somebody in, I don't care who it was. But suddenly, instead of just me watching the performance on stage, I knew there was this person over there, my barber, literally once. It made no difference. But now I'm thinking, how is this being seen through other eyes? And suddenly you realize you've got ways to look at this. So for a whole bunch of reasons. Now, if you want to test how you do in front of a focus group, that's fine. But don't use that as a way to find out about the case.
Okay, yeah, I mean, I totally agree with you. If you want to find out how real people feel about the facts of your case, the evidence, how it's going to come in, it should be neutral. But a lot of things like we're talking about, you need to give your opening statement to strangers a few times, just like you need to practice your voir dire a few times to strangers before you do the real thing.
I don't know if anybody still does this, but I used to gather up on complex cases, complex business, commercial litigation, or medical cases or patent case, I would gather up a group of 14-year-old kids who were of average intelligence to make sure that I could stand there and read basically our case boiled down to 3 pages and then make sure they understood every single word of it. Because if they can't, the jurors won't.
It's a great analogy because I always tell lawyers it should be understood by your middle school age nephew or niece. Yes. And it's the same thing I tell when I'm prepping witnesses. I tell them, when you're being cross-examined by the defense, don't act like it's some adversarial person you're there to argue with and that you hate their guts. Act like every question is a misunderstanding, like it's your nephew or niece asking you, and your answer is going to come across a lot nicer and a lot calmer. And I understand why you might feel that way, but let me explain it to you instead of just like, you know, that's not the answer.
Over the past 5 or 10 years, that is kind of new. And that is, well, Negrelli's stuff is one example of it, but there's a notion of empathy, seeing things through the other person's eyes, including the adversaries, an openness to the human being. This is still a live human event. Not many things are. Jurors are still among the only kinds of government agency that are most of the time free of outside influence, that are there for no particular reason of their own. It's a very unique event. And as such, it is important that we keep it a live event, which you can do on video like we're doing now, better if live, but that it is about ultimately human beings. And if you can get to people on that human level, you're obviously way ahead of the game. And that starts, Vordeer is such an opportunity for that. It's your only real two-way opportunity. So that you listen to people, listen to what they say. Somebody tells you their brother was burned to death in a car, but you don't say, okay, anybody else's brother burned to death in a car? And I'm not exaggerating. I've heard an attorney do that once. Because you're listening for information you can use instead of the interesting human information, which tells you more about jury selection anyway.
Well, I think I really love that. I'm going to use that. What Artemis says is that it's what your mantra you're kind of saying to yourself as they're walking in, because that is exactly the frame of mind you got to be in. And as we know, so much of jury selection is frame of mind. I mean, I used to start out, these people are my enemy. They hate my case. They hate my client. They're going to hate me. I'm the ambulance chaser. Everyone hates ambulance chaser. You know, all these terrible thoughts. And when you have that mentality, you're going to come in and you're going to make them defensive. And they're going to clam up.
Because a fear is, and for a lot of lawyers, especially young lawyers and new lawyers, if fear is your motivating factor in jury selection, fear of the jurors, what are you going to do? Of course, you're going to either attack them a little bit, jump the gun a little bit and say, well, you can't be fair and everything like that. Or what I see happen even more often is you don't really ask questions where you're really looking for answers. I'm afraid of what they're going to say, so I'm not really going to let them talk very much, right?
Let me suggest, if you are a person, as many people are, I mean, look, you didn't go to law school because you were a ballet dancer. The chances are very high, you're very verbally oriented, that you have a little bit more trouble connecting emotionally with people. Not trouble, but your level of doing it is a little less than it might be. But that's a very fixable kind of thing. Rick Friedman has an incredibly useful book out there that when I first looked at it, I thought, oh my God, do I have to read this damn thing? It's a self-help book.
The Zen Lawyer?
No, not The Zen Lawyer. That's Michael Leeserman. It's also a pretty good book. Rick Friedman's is...
Is it Ethos or is it...
The one about Ethos, Beyond Advocacy, The Way of the Lawyer, Beyond... In the title is The Way of the Lawyer, The Way of the... Beyond... Just remember, Beyond Technique is half of the title and it's by Rick Friedman. Trial Guides has it. Who else? And he had asked if I would read it and write a blurb. And of course, I'm always eager to read whatever Rick writes. And I get it and I open up and says, a self-help book. What am I going to do? I can't read this thing. I hate these things. And I just, all right, I just had to force myself. And by about page 7, I thought, this is exactly what I need, what everybody needs. And it helps you create, it helps you develop the part of you that's already there, not putting on a face. It's already there. You know how you deal with children, with their groups of people you feel warm. You know how you can want to do certain things for the right reasons, for human-based reasons. He uses the word ethos, which is a useful way to... Anyway, I suggest that strongly. And then out of that comes a hunger to find out, who are these people sitting here? This is really... I mean, some people would kill for that opportunity. You need to at least take pleasure in it. Not in your manipulative, brilliant methods of getting at what you need to get at. Of course you need all that skill. Rick didn't write Beyond Technique because he meant ignore technique. He meant after you have all your techniques. But that there becomes a personal, there's a hunger in you for these things, the way there's a hunger to watch a good movie. And that's what but whatever you have to do to get yourself up to want to do this, you can't show off your wonderful questions. They're jurors. They don't know a wonderful question from a terrible question. You can't worry about whether the judge and the other people are going to stop you or hate you or whatever that is. If those things are on your mind, that's opening night jitters. That's why we suggest you practice. You do rehearsals. Every other performer, every athlete, every performer that I can think of does that. Once you've done 8,000 jury selections, many, many more than most people ever get to do, maybe you can skip that step.
So, Harry, before you pick a jury, do you practice your Post-it note writing the night before?
Moving it around, this question. Fumbling it. Yeah.
Yeah.
I always make sure to spill a glass of water over my table just so I can do it in court. But no, I mean, like David, I think, and obviously I'm, you know, unlike most lawyers who only get to try a few cases a year at the most, I mean, obviously I've seen so many juries and picked so many juries, but I do have that same mentality that he's talking about of every time I go in there, I'm knowing there are going to be some jurors who were bad, but we're going to identify them. And so when we get bad answers, great. I'm happy. I'm thrilled that we got that because we now know who to get rid of. And I also know that no matter what venue we're in, no matter how many times people warn me, this is a terrible venue. They're going to hate this kind of case. They're going to hate me. And they never give big damages. I know there's going to be some good people there. Oh, yeah. We're going to.
What do you think about venue, David?
What it means is that attorney doesn't know how,
right,
which is a legitimate concern, of course. But that's part of the job of a consultant to help them be able to do that. But face it, most attorneys for most cases are not going to and can't bring in a consultant, at least not a good one, and can't bring them in for very long. So you do need to learn a lot of this stuff for yourself. It's also the advantage of having a good consultant that you work with at least once or twice, because you're not just learning about your case, you're finding out how do these people, and we all work differently. I mean, there's no two consultants that are the same that I know of who are any good. But it's, you know, people say, oh, trial advocacy is an art form. Well, no, it ain't. Any good art form has got a hell of a lot of technique underneath it. It becomes an art form when that technique, you can release yourself and go beyond it. But at that point, you had better be very human-oriented or you're going to do Jackson Pollock, which is not the right art form for trials.
It's not. No, it's not. Well, I mean, defense attorneys, I mean, they throw whatever at the wall and see what sticks, right? I mean, isn't that the...
Well, but that's a technique.
Exactly.
And it's a very good technique. It's an incredibly good technique for them, not for us.
Right. It's not. So, okay, chronologically. So I like the internal, how to get yourself to be a human being. And then what's your advice to the initial extra? What are the things you like to hear the attorneys you work with or you've seen successfully done that they say to really make that comfort for the jurors happen quickly?
I think both Harry and I would have the same kind of response to that, which is, do you have about a week? The thing I would put second is, don't expect jurors to give you a reliable answer to things they've never thought about in their lives until you've asked them now in trial. How do you feel about preponderance? How do you feel about big verdicts? How do you feel about this? How do you feel about that? They don't know. They truly don't. If I ask you a question about something you've never thought about until then, you don't know. So you will come up with something, but it's very hard to rely on that. So I like to craft questions, different ways of doing this, and some people can just do it because they sort of have a feel for it, that don't ask jurors to polarize themselves. Instead of saying, just pick an example, some people, not even that, starting in the wrong place. How many folks here have negative feelings about lawsuits? Well, me, most people have not spent more than 30 minutes in their entire lives thinking about that, if not 30 seconds. So you need to make it easy for them. You say, some folks have some negative feelings about whatever lawsuit. Other folks, they're okay with it. And what I need to ask you, are you a little closer to the folks who have some bad feelings about them and some questions about them? Or are you a little closer to the folks who are okay with them? The answer to that question doesn't tell you anything. It is the follow-up. And the only follow-up question you need, in my mind, is tell me about that.
Yeah.
Whatever they say, I'm a little closer this way, a little closer that way. And if you have to start with a group question, how many of you lean a little this way? How many of you? But if you say, are you for or against something? Preponderance, for example, which people do not spend enough time either teaching or getting jurors to do. And one of the great places to ground that is in voir dire. You can get every jury using preponderance almost every time, but it's a little bit of work and you need to learn how. But the way you do it is not by saying, are you for it or against it? Who in real life has ever thought about whether they're for or against preponderance And yet we need to know. So you need to lead them into it and not get them to polarize, or they will. Sounds like a terrible idea. It sucks. How many of you think $10 million is too much for a verdict? And a lot of people raise your hands and you cut them. But what we found constantly in focus groups is that means nothing to them after they learn about the case and they see what happened if you've given it an effective damages thing. So don't expect jurors to be able to know what no human being can know. It's one of the uses of a really good trial consultant, is to be able to see beyond that sort of thing, or at least be able to help the attorney see beyond that sort of thing. So you can see there are some ways a juror can say $10 million is too much. That may indicate a problem you need to follow up on. And other ways that if you follow up, you find out there's no problem there at all.
Yeah, that kind of falls under the topic that I teach a lot, which is don't allow your juror to self-diagnose.
That's such a nice way of putting it. Yeah. That is such a great way.
That's your job. And that's why the questions that I always have attorneys, my favorite questions are always just like, introduce the topic and say, what are your thoughts and feelings about how companies should handle this situation or that situation or how people should do this? Because ultimately, all you can ask them are the thoughts and feelings that are kind of popping in their heads. And you're not asking them, give me your final answer in 10 seconds before I move on to the next guy. And then you have to, I've seen a million times where jurors will tell you, I don't think I'd be very good for you. And you hear how they feel and you're going, I think you're pretty wrong about that, or vice versa. I think I'd be pretty good for you. And you go, yeah, you really wouldn't be, because they don't know the facts of your case and they don't know what the defense is going to say. But I see so many lawyers these days trying to put the burden of diagnosing it on the jurors and saying,
I never thought of it that way. That is brilliant. I love it. I love this.
Well, just Harry, for our listeners, elaborate what you mean by self-diagnosis.
Sure. Have them tell you if they're bad for you, if they're good for you, if they can be fair or not. You know, that's your job to figure that out. And certainly if you think that somebody is, you're hearing things and you're like, this guy wouldn't be right. And he's given the benefit of the doubt to the doctor in all these situations in a med mal case. Yeah, certainly you can try to lead them down and try to get them for cause, but don't rely on them telling you who here would be bad for me. Okay. And I don't have to ask any more questions because they told me who's good or bad.
However, once you do know you want to get rid of somebody, I flip that advice.
Yes.
When you're going after them for cause, you do want them to self-diagnose. They've already started, and you want to encourage that right up to the point of saying, so am I correct? I see your person is obviously able to express yourself clearly and firm-minded about things, that even if the judge says you have to stop thinking that way in order to be a juror on this case, that you would have to say to the judge, well, that's out of my ballpark because I wouldn't stop thinking that way.
Right, because you've diagnosed them and then you're going, okay, I've diagnosed this guy. Now you can get them to say, yeah, you're right.
So you get them to take themselves off the jury instead of you browbeating them.
And then the other jurors see how you did that and they'll kind of come out a little more and maybe they'll express similar feelings. But
you just have to be careful you're not giving jurors you like a way to get themselves off, which is another one of my pet peeves. The fact that a juror does not want to serve does not make them a bad plaintiff's juror. It does not make them a good defense juror. It doesn't make them anything. I have seen jurors so angry that the judge forced them to come back the next day that they went out and slammed the door of the courtroom. Come back, be the greatest, some of the greatest plaintiff's jurors.
I do agree, but I think this is a really important point because I think conventional wisdom is a mad juror is going to be bad for plaintiff who does not want to be there. So
I'm not sure. There's a lot of conventional wisdom that I think is nonsense. Eye contact. We are taught eye contact is good. You must have eye contact all the time. Yes, except if you have a juror who's leaning against you in closing or you suspect that they are, eye contact makes them harder for your other jurors to win over. It hardens their hearts against you. When somebody's angry, watching you talk, and you don't want that kind of contact with that person. So there's all this conventional wisdom. It's sort of like everybody takes the erring younger's 10 commandments of cross-examination. That's for L3. It's not for practicing lawyers.
I was just going to say the Irving Younger, to not know the answer.
He was right.
Right. But it's okay to not know the answer and ask a question. You said so, you both reacted. I do want to come back to this. When David said that not enough jurors focus on preponderance of the evidence in jury selection, and you both had a strong reaction. And so I want to hear one, why you think that is, and two, what we should do in jury selection to bring it out and talk about it.
Harry, you want to start for
today? Sure. I'll give my take, and I don't know if I wouldn't say it's a universally accepted thing. I never touch preponderance or burden of proof in civil cases in jury selection. I've never found to be one of those things that doesn't really tell you much about jurors. And in fact, when I used to do lots and lots of big data types of things, I would always find that actually jurors who say, I kind of have an issue with it, actually tend to be a little bit better jurors for you because they're a little bit more conscientious. But it's so easy to fool jurors when you're talking about that and thinking that makes me bad for you. You know, at the end of the day, I saw a lawyer recently on a podcast say something kind of revolutionary that I don't know if I would do it, but I kind of liked it. It made me smile, where he said, I tell the jurors, we're going to prove it by clear and convincing evidence. Is that okay with you? And if we don't, fine against us. I don't think jurors really differentiate that much. If you win them over, I mean, you're not going in there trying to win by a hair. And if you are winning by a hair, you're probably not trying your case the best way. I don't think those questions really tell you which jurors are going to. There's other ways of getting at those, you know, really tough engineering type jurors who would say, if I have any shadow of a doubt, I don't think that I could find for you. But that's a different kind of voir dire question. So I don't touch it. I don't worry about it.
So you're saying don't talk about burden of proof or preponderance, Harry?
I don't. I mean, for example, in wrongful termination employment cases, there's a way that I like to talk about the fact that you're going to have to decide based on circumstantial evidence and why you're going to have to second guess employer, because they're never going to tell you, oh, well, we fired him because of his race. You know, they're not going to tell you that. It's not going to be in an email. But I don't talk about preponderance and the burden of proof. I just talk about reliance on, can you potentially second guess and overrule somebody if they're telling you one thing? But that's a little bit different, I think. I don't touch burden of proof.
Or, well, David, go ahead.
Well, it's not that I differ, because there's different ways for different people. Right. A lesson it has taken me a lifetime to come to truly believe. If you catch me in the first half to two-thirds of my career, it was, do it this way or you will die and go to hell screaming. A number of people did not obey me and died and went to hell screaming, so I had good evidence. It's not a cookie-cutter thing. My feeling is, I have watched too many cases in which one of the things I did was spend a lot of time talking with jurors. I did this for years after trials when I could, and talking with a lot of people who weren't jurors, but just what their attitudes were. And especially with that first group, so many times we were just about certain, but they just didn't prove it. We just didn't buy it. Well, didn't you use preponderance of evidence? Yeah, we thought it was very likely that he was definitely wrong. And so they're not using preponderance. And I did find a way that you can teach them to, and more importantly, persuade them to apply preponderance. And it gets particularly important on the size of the verdict, on the damages thing. So I did find it useful and important to do that. However, it's a multi-step process and it's not easy to do. I've recently been applying the same thing in criminal cases. I know we're not here today about criminal cases, but in getting jurors to decide cases on the basis of preponderance, on the basis of beyond reasonable doubt, it's a flip side. But jurors never, ever do that in criminal cases. And every attorney in the world says, don't even try to get them to do that. And I was saying, well, we're losing 80% of our cases that are lost because they're not using beyond reasonable doubt. So what I have developed over time is, in my mind, I want jurors who will follow the law. I really want jurors, unless I'm working for a really bad case. But if they're going to follow the law, we're going to get a win and we're going to get a good amount of money here. So I want jurors for whom the law becomes sacrosanct. And teaching preponderance and persuading preponderance and questioning about preponderance in voir dire becomes a very good way to find out who the jurors are who are going to follow the law without them ever telling you, oh, yes, I'll follow the law. So it serves multiple purposes.
So what are the questions?
Well, it's more, like I say, it's in Damages 3, and it takes a chapter by itself.
Yeah.
It involves turning the concept of preponderance into the rules of the game. You know, the rules of the road, except there are rules for jurors as well. For example, one of the rules is that you don't allow yourself to be bullied or threatened during deliberations by another juror. You don't allow yourself to be swayed by a juror who's stepping outside the law, wants to violate this jury that you're on, that you have to live with the knowledge that you were on the jury that led the jury to step outside the law. So you get rid of a whole bunch of the normal biases and attitudes that can otherwise affect the verdict. But that is a project. If I were really going to teach that, I would want a 3-hour session with a group of people or a chapter in a book.
Yeah.
There are some shortcuts. Gary Johnson, one of my idols of attorneys, was also the first attorney that ever hired me about 800 years ago. So I know he's insane. Would say, you can have doubts. You're going to find doubts on both sides. Just like anything else in life, there's doubts. And the only question here is, which side do you have the less doubts about?
So one way I've seen, where if you're getting into the money, and I do want to hear after we thank our sponsors here in a second, I do want to hear how you ask about money or how you lead up to it. But preponderance may come in sometimes if you're saying 1 million to 5 million. As you go higher, are you going to hold me to a higher burden of proof?
It's also, some jurors will feel, unless you handle this carefully, that if they're not 100% convinced, then you shouldn't give them 100% of the money. You have to anticipate that. It's a very complicated subject, which is why a lot of attorneys don't like to go near it, although Harry's got some good reasons for not doing it. And this becomes extremely attorney dependent. It really depends on the kind of person and the skill levels of attorneys. All I know is I was an engineer before everything else. And my chief approach to everything was failure analysis, long before I was going to be a trial consultant. If I'd stayed in engineering, I'm sure I would have been a failure engineer. Not a failed engineer, I hope, but a failure analysis, which is very useful when it comes to looking at what the damn defense did. What was the failing, what they did? Where's the systemic failure, et cetera? And I did find that when you look at a case and say, this is a winnable case, one of the most common reasons it lost was because jurors did not apply preponderance.
Right.
And you can get them to do it. And it almost always can result in a better dollar verdict because they're all compromising on these things. And you can get them to see it doesn't, they just didn't prove to me this is a $10 million case. And you hear that a lot because they've made such a strong way to argue the high damages figures. But that's a gift and hard to learn, and most people don't do that. So there's a lot of, as I said, a lot of permutations here, and I have a lot of different feelings about it. But ultimately, we have the easiest burden of proof on the planet. The only easier one is for a lawyer to get a jury to find reasonable doubt. And my experience has been lawyers don't know how to exploit either one of those. That's why I like to teach about preponderance. And in fact, that's the whole book that I wrote on criminal defense. It's basically, how do you get juries to decide cases based on reasonable doubt? And pretty much every time. And that's, obviously having a huge effect.
Yeah.
Once you can get to that point.
Well, after the break, I want to hear about how you get to the money question. But let's take a quick break.
Let's thank our first sponsor. I'm very excited for this gentleman who has decided to support this show. He's a very good friend of mine, John Tisa of Tisa Film and Tech. He has been my trial tech, I think, for the last 10 years. One of my first big trials, he was there working for another company. John Tisa really is just one of the best out there, a very humble guy. But if you need a trial tech, someone that is literally going to work any hours, anytime, he is available. He's quick. He is makes your trials seamless, easy. He can do it all, really. We use him for literally everything technological in trial. He does our depo clips. We play a lot of depos and opening throughout our case. He'll do clips on the fly. He helps me with all my PowerPoints and opening statement. He is my right-hand man at trial. He'll sit there in the hot seat. Great with exhibits. Really, I just can't speak highly enough of John Tisa from Tisa Film and Tech. He's doing cases throughout California, but I know he's starting to expand out of state. He has an amazing team of people. When he's in trial and I need him, he always gets me someone who is top notch so I really can put on the best case. I can't recommend John Tisa from Tisa Film and Tech
If you're trying to do all that stuff on your own, man, you're missing something in terms of prepping for the actual jury. So you guys, if you're trying a case, you need somebody doing that tech, all that stuff for you after hours. I mean, after hours, you're prepping for the next plaintiff. You're not putting together like depo clips and demonstratives and things like that, right, Dan?
No, man. I mean, not at all. That recent verdict we had in San Diego, I mean, he was working with us. We had a lot of depo clips from video witnesses, like lay witnesses, and he put together this beautiful like montage. It was almost like a documentary, just all these like things these people were saying about my client who suffered a traumatic brain injury. And he put together this thing that was like a documentary that I was able to play in closing because it was all in evidence, and it just looked so good and so clean, and the jury really liked it. So can't speak highly enough of John Tisa.
How do you get in touch with him? How do you spell his last name for the viewers who want to get in touch with him? Or how do you get in touch with him?
Tisa, T-I-S-A, film and tech. And his information will be on all of our promotional materials and all that. So John Tisa, one of the top out there. Our next sponsor, who is always supportive of our podcast and the Plaintiff's Bar, is Melissa Baldwin from Baldwin Settlements. She really is the go-to structured settlement vendor out there. She's another person that I have known for over a decade. Extremely supportive of the Plaintiff's Bar, CALA, CAOC, AAJ. She will get the best deals for your clients, get them the most money in their pockets from a structured settlement. She works great with clients who may not be that sophisticated. I had a really catastrophic injury death, where my client was not very sophisticated. He had some drug issues, and she was able to speak at his level and get him to do a structure that really helped set him up and his family up for the rest of their lives. Got him a great rate. She also structures attorney's fees, which is something I've started to do lately. Just structuring fees so you can kind of have a little nest egg built up for either your business or yourself. Melissa Baldwin from Baldwin Settlements, really just a fantastic person, a great businesswoman, a great mother, and a great friend who I highly recommend. Melissa Baldwin from Baldwin Settlements. So with that, thank you to our sponsors. Let's get back to this great show we got.
So David, you briefly touched on it, and Harry, jump in too, but you said about who here has a problem awarding $10 million?
Well, I'm not against asking it. I'm just against relying on it too much. If a juror has a lot of other good characteristics, whatever they may be, that is an outweighable one because the juror doesn't really know that. However, a way to find out is somebody said, I could never go above $10 million. And if you ask what I call the all-purpose follow-up question, tell me a little more about that. So you find out, is this a deep-seated bias that's been, say, inculcated by the tort reform movement over the years or some terrible experience, or I'm a small businessman, I only carry so much insurance, etc. Is there real reason for that? Because if there isn't, when he hears about this case, let's say you are successful in ginning up a good amount of anger at the defendant, or a great amount of empathy for what's happened to your clients, or whatever, however you go about getting the verdict up there, then I'm not afraid of answers like that.
Because that's another one of those things Harry and I talk about a lot. They have never thought about this. And if they're saying 2 million, I don't know, 3 million, 10 million, whatever they're throwing out there, but if they're like hesitant, they've never thought about this before today.
Even if they're not hesitant, that, you know, people want to sound like they know what they're talking about. I would never do that. But you need to tell me about it.
Say more, yeah.
And I learned a question from John Edwards, a very good trial lawyer and senator, is, look, my own mother is against any verdict as big as we're going to be asking you for in this case. It was going to be $10 or $20 million. And my mother would, I know what she would say. She'd say, never, I'm not going that high. Other folks would think it's okay. And so now you've given the jurors permission to give you the bad answer. And it's okay to say the wrong thing. So now your only job is to get them talking enough. You can't second guess what's really in their heads. That's why the follow-up is so important. Artemis is constantly telling people, if you have a limited time for jury selection, you can't do 22 questions. Do two, do three, pick the most important one so that you have some time to spend on each one. Yes and no answers mean nothing. You learn nothing from the answer to, and I'm against that.
How do you like introducing the concept of money, pain and suffering, non-economic? Like, what's your way to get into it?
There's a lot of ways. Mainly, I want the attorney to be comfortable with it. Attorneys, for example, who are going to want a really huge verdict had better be comfortable asking for that huge verdict. I think of it like fundraising specialists at universities. will sit at a table with somebody and say, will you be okay putting us down for $5 million on your list of gifts? I could never do that.
Yeah.
But you have to make yourself comfortable doing that. But one way that I like is some judges won't let you do that, but you could simply say, some folks think that verdicts are too high these days. Some folks think, you know, 5 or 10 or 15 or 20, objection. The other side will say they're trying to anchor the dollar figure, which of course it might be. But you don't need to mention the dollar figure. Let them go there. Some folks feel that some verdicts they hear about these days are just too big and that some people are winning cases. Maybe you should not be winning. Talk to me about that. Or what Harry was suggesting earlier, let them diagnose themselves. Let them lead themselves into it. There's also more specific ways of doing it. Some people feel that $20 million in a case is too much, no matter what the evidence is. My own mother would say that. Other folks are okay with it, think it depends on the case, which you're a little closer to. And you'll get some good talk out of that, but the specific, I'm against that, doesn't give you the answer. It's the, tell me about that. Well, I don't know, it just seems, well, that's not a dangerous juror. Oh no, that's what's causing all the doctors to leave the state of Texas. I mean, all the doctors are leaving every state, according to the tort reform movement. They live in.
Where are they going, by the way?
That was
the Caymans or something?
Well, also, we know now that where they have very strict tort reform limits, insurance is just as expensive for doctors.
Yeah, doctors aren't all of a sudden showing up in Arkansas.
Well, we can't win that one because the law is not there to be fair. It's there to protect the doctors.
Yeah.
So it's hard to get the legislatures to change their minds about that. But I don't want to quick answer your question because there's so many different ways of doing that. And it so depends on the case. It also depends what you're doing for a deer. One series of questions I like is asking the jurors about every single serious harm in the case. Who here themselves knows anybody, or themselves perhaps, who's been in a wheelchair for any period of time, who's done this, experienced that, who knows somebody who's been in that situation? And then ask them about money, because now they know about your damages case once you've asked those questions. But I don't think I have any magic bullet questions, and I don't like magic bullet questions. I finally did learn not everybody is, I don't know why I thought of it that way, because I didn't think actors were well trained that way, that every actor should use the same techniques.
Yeah, I love the scaling and grouping, just kind of like who leans a little bit this way, who leans a little bit that way, and you just apply it. I mean, this is the technique part more than the art, like you said, because you can apply it to all of your topics. You go down, as long as you give people, and you use the jury rail as your spectrum. Over here's people who feel this way, way over here people, and then who leans a little bit, because no one likes to be put in a box or like labeled.
That leads you to one of the great voir dire questions, which is get the jurors deliberating in front of you during jury selection.
Right. Exactly.
Mr. Smith, you looked like you didn't agree with Mr. Jones quite. Tell me what you were thinking at that point, or tell us what you were thinking at that point.
And then you're just the maestro. You're just like getting them to talk. And
but
to,
you have to do this as if you really like these people. Not, he gave a bad opinion. You gave a good opinion. Right. Let's see the two of you duke it out. It's not like that at all.
I agree.
And stop worrying about the damn judge during jury selection. It is not the end of the world if the judge sustains an objection against you. It really is not. In fact, I tell people, object as little as possible. It makes you look bad when you object, trying to hide something.
I think that's one of the biggest fears as a younger lawyer I used to have is just like, I want the judge to love my voir dire. I want him to say I did such a great job or all this stuff. And that's not who the person you're trying to decide your case.
Something important out of Rick's book. The things that you're concerned about. Paying my office rent, paying the staff, having enough money, not looking foolish, hating the thought of losing, all those things that take over, you need, and this is a lifetime of development, this isn't a trick, those should not be part of your being when you stand up in front of a jury to do your work, because then you're working for the wrong, Mo Levine used to say the right verdict for the right reason, the right advocacy for the right reason. You are there to right a wrong, you are there because you are. Superman is not thinking, if I beat the hell out of the bad guys, I'll have more money to buy a new house. He's thinking the right thoughts. The heroes think the right thoughts. You need to be thinking, not just thinking, but that must be the thing that drives you.
That's so funny you say that, like literally, because my method is I listen to the Superman theme song right before I'm about to start jury selection, because that gets my mind out of all the other bullshit I'm thinking about, yes, what's going on at home. Like you said, whatever.
This is a similar technique. I can't remember if I stole or invented, because it's a long time ago. But like I say, I steal things for a living and sell them to other people. But I've seen it now, so I can't remember if this is the first time I saw it or if I suggested the guy do it. But before he gets up to do voir dire, he opens the lid of his briefcase, which is facing him and not the jury, and he studies it for a moment as if he's looking at his notes just before he gets up to do voir dire or opening or even an examination. He's looking at a picture of his little girl. Hey, Dad. Now, I don't have children, but I can imagine what an effect in the middle of a horrible work day of tension and judges. You. I love this kid. Just carry that up to the jury.
Yes.
Hum to yourself a song like you do. What's your upbeat music?
Yeah, all of that stuff. Headspace is so important.
I've always been on the verge of doing a book about how do you get yourself into the right frame of mind, mood, to do these things. Some chapters in various things that I've written, but I really think that does. I don't think many people would buy the book because it's fuzzy stuff. Lawyers like specific stuff, but still.
But your mental state is everything when you're going to talk to 40 strangers who you've never met before. And if you like any kind of confidence you have, you know, you're single, you're going out on a date, like all these things, it's your mindset. If you're in a confident place, you're going to want to learn, listen.
Or you just figuratively puking is not a good idea.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you don't want to do that. You don't want to really puke on a date, your first date either. That's not a good idea.
It humanizes you. No. But let me go on a tangent real quick, because you brought up one thing that I was thinking is when you're talking about superheroes here, David talked about assuming that jurors are going to have some well-formed answer to the questions that you're asking. And one thing I always teach too, and I want to hear Dan and David, your thoughts on, are a mistake I see made is that lawyers assume that jurors' experiences that they've had are going to tell you how they now feel about something. And I always tell lawyers, it's kind of like a superhero origins. The superhero and the supervillain have had the same thing. You know, like Batman's parents were killed tragically, and so was the supervillain. And the only difference is how they handled that. And the superheroes are the ones who say, I'm never going to let that happen to anybody else. And the supervillains are going, everybody else is going to feel that pain. And so in jury selection, you hear a juror say, well, I once had this happen to me. A doctor once screwed up my aunt's surgery. And a lot of lawyers go, oh, I know exactly how that person is going to be in this case. And they could not be more dead wrong. Guys, I want to hear your thoughts on that. Lawyers.
That is a great analogy. I love that, actually. Go ahead, yeah. David.
The example I use of that is, and again, I think this came out of having actually watched something in trial. Somebody had said that they had been involved in a very bad car wreck when they were driving. And it was a terrible car wreck. I mean, it was awful. Somebody was killed. Grandma, who was sitting next to me, is still hobbling around to this day on her crutches because of what happened in that wreck. It was terrible. Some people would write down, get rid of that juror. I mean, let's keep that juror. They've had this experience. They know what it feels like. I said, well, I don't know. Let's follow up a little bit more. Just tell me more about that. And the next thing the person says, and I may have invented this or seen it, I don't know, but it serves as an example. Tell me more about that. It was awful. Everybody blamed me. The other side, the lady who's the widow of the poor guy who was killed, blames me for the wreck. The cops blame me. Grandma, to this day, glares at me when she hobbles past me. I don't want that juror.
Yeah.
Or I probably don't want that juror, but I would not have known that if I just went. The experience is like a closed-ended question. It tells you this might be a hot-button issue for this juror, but now you got to figure out which side's the hot side.
Yeah, yes, I totally agree with you. I'm also thinking, though, if I see that, I just generally don't like someone who has a very similar injury or experience.
Oh, you can't go there. You can't.
I mean, I'd almost not even ask that, because now I think the defense would now be educated to not ding. Whereas if they just heard about the injury, if I didn't ask that question you asked, I would just let it lie, and then the defense is going to ding that portion for me.
Yeah, if you can possibly do that, we've always told people in that situation, or any other reason why somebody's a loose cannon. It could be for one side or the other, but a juror who suffered the same injury is a loose cannon. You have no idea unless you've done a very thorough voir dire, unless you do something else that can help a great deal that is brand new, well, brand new to an old guy like me, and that is you can learn an enormous amount about prospective jurors online.
Oh, yeah.
Properly following the rules. You don't make contact with them. You don't use LinkedIn without checking the thing that says, let me snoop around anonymously. But Artemis and I were doing a jury selection in Florida. It was just before COVID, so it's a while ago now. And now things are even better because there's so much more ways to research. Artemis was at home in Chapel Hill, and I am sitting in trial. And it was a three-week jury selection. And the plaintiff's attorney was one of the really great attorneys in Florida, doing a superb job with his voir dire. And we learned a lot about the jurors in trial and voir dire. We learned more from what Artemis and a small group of people were rapidly getting online about these people. Now, when your time is more concentrated, that's even a greater value.
Well, let me ask you then, in that situation, that was the information you're getting, were you thinking, this juror is giving me great answers, but I'm finding something on their Facebook?
That's one of the things. You never know what you're going to find. Are we getting things that are going along with this person? Is it opening? What are their... Facebook. Go to somebody's Facebook. Go to somebody's social media. Do they take part, for example, in charitable activities that benefit other people that are not strictly limited to the church? Because that's kind of an exception to judging whether somebody's generous, because they can be doing that for other reasons, not necessarily, but maybe. But you can see what they do with their lives. And if you have, you know, a half hour, an hour, or 2 hours for voir dire, that's the most information you're going to get. But it's amazing the stuff you can find out. Similarly, make sure you know what the jurors are going to find out about your client and you when they go online, because they will go online. They will go online during the first break they have. They'll go in the bathroom. They'll all be sitting there on their phones looking stuff up in case you need to.
No, we've actually kept it pretty clean there.
Because, well, I didn't know if you guys had.
No, today we have for some reason, but we're going to fucking stop that now.
Anyway, the internet has changed a whole lot of things, just as big data has changed a whole lot of things. You need to deal with them very carefully. There's not automatic solutions, but there's a whole lot there. And I'm watching younger consultants and younger attorneys doing stuff and able to learn stuff that I was not ever coming here.
Well, because we'll wrap up soon, but I do kind of want to go here now because, I mean, but what information, though, what the data you're going to get online, right? The person supports Trump or doesn't, or the person volunteers a lot, or I don't know, they, whatever you're going to, information you're going to get from LinkedIn.
Are they mean-spirited? Are they selfish? Is this a high ego? Do they seem to be leaders? Well, I'm telling you, what you can learn by looking at somebody's social media, enough of it, and that doesn't take long. Are they mean-spirited people? Are they nasty people? Are they generous people? Are they people-oriented people? Are they leaders? Do they seem to be leaders in their circle? Because leaders can be very, you better damn well know that that juror is going to be good for you before you allow that juror to be seated. Better to get rid of a questionable juror leader than a very bad non-leader. There's no limit to the stuff you can find out. You won't realize this till you find it, although it helps to talk with people who've done it. There are some services that do it, which cases that have been on have used from time to time, and they do an okay job. They do a better job if you could help them more. This is the kind of thing we're looking for. And then sometimes you do find that you're just dealing with a flat-out liar.
Yeah, I think that's key.
For some reason or other is trying to get on this jury, and that's a really dangerous sign.
That's where I've used it. So we've been doing that for almost 8 years now. We have a whole Google sheet, sends back to everyone in our office. Once we get the names, they fill it in. It looks tough. I don't know if I've ever, and Harry's picked my last, I don't know, 10 jurors, 8 jurors or something. I don't know if I've ever really used that data, honestly.
Well, stop thinking of it as data. It is finding human stuff about them. It's very hard to find in trial. And the shorter time you have for jury selection, the harder it is to get that stuff in the courtroom.
Yeah.
If you've got forever, I would still do it. There's nothing to be lost except a little bit of time, and it's not very expensive work to have done. It's completely replaced what I never understood of great value, which was the drive-by. you'd send an investigator out and they'd drive by every name on the prospective juror's house. Oh, neat lawn, toys in the yard, they've got children, all this stuff you're going to find out anyway. But this, you really do find out maybe 1 in 4, 1 in 5 people, you find out some stuff that's useful. And when you are on the line about somebody, you know, that awful position of I've only got so many strikes, et cetera. And in some states like North Carolina, where you can't backstrike, this stuff becomes even more important. So I do think it's useful, but you need to develop a knowledge of the kind of thing you're looking for. And that would be best developed with somebody who has done a lot of, a lawyer who has done a lot of those things and has found value in them. I don't think it's ever failed. It's like a focus group.
Yeah, no, I think I'm always going to do it. I just was curious.
Sometimes you find it's limited because what are your folks looking for?
Exactly.
Are they looking for data? Well, that's going to narrow. They're looking for facts. Well, we're also looking for, what's the tone of those emails? Mm-hmm. Are they quick to start kicking people in the butt? That alone doesn't mean anything bad. But that, taken with the impression you get in trial, that can be very, very useful stuff. It also tells you stuff, and I do want to get this in. What you learn online and what you learn in trial in the courtroom during voir dire is very good information for learning how to do your case. Those are the people, know your audience. I forget who the lawyer was who suggested this. Artemis now tells people this all the time. I hope they do it. You come in the morning about a half hour early. You take your overview outline notes from each juror. You sit in juror number one's chair and you look at your notes on that juror. And you say to yourself, okay, well, how's he going to see today? How did he see yesterday? Then you move to the next. You physically sit yourself there. This is a great way to develop empathy for the people who are sitting there. And it will keep you in mind of that jury and working for that jury the whole time. This is post, obviously. But the case is about the jurors. It ain't about whether the judge likes you. And it's not even about whether your client likes you. It's about whether the jurors, the more you know about how that person listens, the more you can unconsciously connect. That's why you sit in their chair. What does it feel like to be them? It's that empathy means seeing things through their eyes, really feeling and seeing things through their eyes.
Yeah, it's something lawyers don't do enough of, is really try to put themselves in the juror's shoes.
They don't even do it with their clients.
No.
Plus the other side's clients or the lawyer on the other side. Boy, can you learn a lot about how to handle that defense attorney once you've really seen the world from their point of view and not just that they're a son of a bitch.
Harry, what are your thoughts on the online data before we wrap up?
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things where I think, like David said, 90-something percent of the stuff that you find is not useful. But when you do find something, especially on someone that you're particularly concerned about, this person is going to be a leader, this person is, you know, they're professional, and they're going to, when you do find something, it's very important. I mean, I remember years ago, there was a juror who was like some sort of management consultant or something like that. And we're going, I don't know if we're going to like this guy. And I look him up, and what does he teach and what does he write about? And he was entirely taught ethical management and teaching corporations ethics. And I went, oh, this guy's a lot better than I thought. But it could go the other way too. So it just, you know, you get a journalist and you see what they write about. And I remember there was a trial last year where there was a guy who mentioned that he had run for, I think, Congress or state Congress or something. I pulled up the guy's platforms on the thing and I went, okay, this is exactly the kind of juror that we want. He happened to be a very strong Trump supporting juror, but our guy just matched what we were looking for in the case. And I had to convince the plaintiff attorney, no, this guy, they're like, are you kidding me? They looked at me like, we're keeping this guy? No way.
And be very careful about these little shortcuts. I mean, for years, I hope we've made some headway now, but for years, the assumption was conservative juries don't pay big money. Yeah. It's actually the reverse.
I agree.
Especially if you're doing a rules-based or a process-based case, who gets the most upset if somebody doesn't do what they're supposed to do? Not us hippies.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. I think bigger awards for people who get angry about and take their oaths seriously. Like you're talking about following the rules, that their own laws, the own rules they have to follow.
Yeah.
Well, this is great stuff, David. Thank you so much.
Well, man. I loved, I've been eager to learn something about Harry for years since I've been hearing about him. I had no idea you were from Duke, or I just would have gone over and gone into the records office, to which I still have a key.
Really?
I don't know. You probably lived in the fraternity house across the street from you.
I did not. I did not play lacrosse. Yeah.
Yeah.
You didn't play lacrosse.
Huh? I did not. No.
My mom grew up on Watt Street,
Really?
Yeah, I used to walk around.
And I'm going to walk from here.
That's amazing. Is Bullock's Barbecue still open?
Yes, indeed.
I love Bullock's Barbecue.
It's still there. The city is very different. It's huge.
It's a big food scene now.
There's lots of microbreweries all over downtown. All over the place. There's like 30 of them.
The relations between the university and the town are always a little bit strained, but they're much, much better now than they were years ago.
Yes.
The university is very diverse now compared to what it was. When I was there in 85, only 10 or 15 years earlier, the medical center had a limited number of beds available for Black patients. That's how, I mean, this is the South.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And a guy came in and took it over and really just turned the whole ship aside. A guy named Bill Anlian, who in my mind was one of the great human beings I've ever known. But he did, and the university has done a lot. And it's a great school for everything except the arts.
That's funny.
It's better now for the arts than it was, but it's just, they want extracurricular arts. They don't want their kids to go be artists.
Yeah, it's a liberal arts school primarily, but it's also a place where, you know, you go, I'm not paying Duke money for you to do something fun. I mean.
And since you were there, Harry, I don't know how much of this was there at the time, but Duke Science Center is now, you know, world-class. It's as big as the whole rest of the university put together now. And I've done a lot of work over there with there's this thing called the Duke Institute for Brain Sciences. I worked on a research project that was being funded by the National Science Foundation. Yeah, it was peripheral because I'm not that kind of science. I'm not a scientist. But they needed what Artemis and I knew about juries to be able to, anyway. Very impressive people, very impressive contributions that were literally built out of nothing from when I was there in 85. So the place has changed a great deal.
Yeah. All right. Durham, North Carolina, getting a lot of shout outs. I love this. And my mom's going to listen to the episode. She's going to be very
excited.
And
you watch those Blue Devils this year.
Oh, Connor Flagg? Yeah, man.
Cooper, yeah.
Cooper, God, yeah. Sorry. My son's name is Connor. Cooper Flagg.
Yeah, he may turn out to be the second best one, we'll see.
Yeah, he's incredible. All right, David Ball, thank you so much, man. This has been a real pleasure. Love talking to you. Harry, on to the next one. I want to thank Law Pods for making this possible, really helping a lot of trial attorneys out there who maybe don't have mentors, maybe started their own firm out of law school, learning how to try cases the right way. So thank you so much to Law Pods and all our sponsors. Take care.
Thanks, everybody.
If you're enjoying the podcast, the best compliment you can give us is sharing it with a colleague who would find it valuable. For all the best clips from the podcast, follow us on social media. You can find those links in the show notes. Have a jury selection story to share? Email us at podcast@pickingjustice.com and we may address it in a future episode. Until next time, remember, you're not just picking a jury, you're picking justice. Produced and powered by Law Pods.